Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Dreamcatcher, Project Narwhal, the Data Trust, the Catalyst. These aren't code names for Cold War operations. They're the projects and strategies used by the Obama re-election campaign and other political giants to reach voters in this 2012 election. If you thought Obama 2008 was a savvy operation, get ready for the modern landscape of campaigning, where online ads play just for you and no robocall is generic. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. Sasha Eisenberg writes about the science of political campaigns for Slate. His book on the subject, The Victory Lab, will be published this fall. He joins us from London. Welcome back to WNYC, Sasha.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
By now, most people are familiar with how Amazon and Facebook and other online giants analyze our clicks and likes and purchases in order to tailor their advertising. Tell us how this strategy applies to political campaigns. Does it operate on the same principle?
Somewhat. I mean, the big challenge for political campaigns is that we have a decent trove of offline information through things as basic as your voter registration history, which has a party attached to you, where you live, your gender, and often information that campaigns and parties and organizations have generated through canvassing or phone calls when they ask you who you're going to support or what issues you care about. And then there's all the stuff that, as you mentioned, Amazon or other folks can do online to sort of track your online behaviors. The big breakthroughs we're seeing this year are people finally being able to fuse offline knowledge about an individual that's validated with what that person is doing online so that you can reach them there and interact with them. Because ultimately, of course, voting is an offline behavior. And you have to sort of close that circuit. It's all well and good to throw web ads at people or get them to move in and out of a site, but if you don't know who they are and where they vote and what party they are, it's either inefficient or often counterproductive.
So this is recent, this ability to fuse these two data banks?
Basically, yeah. I mean, so there were huge innovations in the ability to integrate and process and analyze offline data over the last 10 to 15 years. The campaign world has sort of generally lumped together as micro-targeting, a big shift that took place going from sort of geographical targeting to individual-level targeting. What's happening this year is being able to keep those individual identities intact when you're trying to communicate with people online.
You wrote recently about a project with the codename Dreamcatcher out of Obama's Chicago headquarters. Describe it. What does it do? How does it work?
So it's a text analytics project, as best I've been able to report. The idea is that there's all this. So we were just talking a few minutes ago about sort of hard information, your party registration, demographic variables, information that sort of define you. There's all this soft information that gets transferred from voters to campaigns. It's the type of thing where if the canvasser comes to your door and asks you, who do you think you're likely to vote for? You'll tell them something that can easily be converted into a one or a two. You know, Romney is one, Obama is two. But if you tell that canvasser that you're thinking about voting for Romney because you don't like bailouts and you're worried about the auto industry and you think the economy's bad, the canvasser will start writing, you know, doesn't like bailouts, auto industry, economy, worried about economy on the clipboard. That information often had nowhere to go, mm-hmm. And so it doesn't easily turn into a one or a two. And so the challenge of the Dreamcatcher project is to effectively turn that into a number that can then be pooled with all the other stuff that is easily represented as numbers. And once you have it, all this stuff as variables that can sort of be interchanged, then you can build algorithms that become predictive. And so if you're able to figure out whether, you know, because in a different context, of course, somebody saying that bailouts in the auto industry could be a piece of information that Obama's team wants to have because they think of that person as targetable. Maybe you know, they said that they use those words because they are sympathetic to what the president has done with the auto industry. And so being able to transfer all that information into usable information in bulk so that it can be manipulated the same way you'd manipulate, you know, gender or race or party identification in an algorithm is the challenge. And so they've been building up a sort of big category, a sort of big repository of this text information and
it's not
ways to make it patterns out
of
it.
And it's not a canvasser with a clipboard. It's the campaign asking supporters to send them their stories, right?
Right. Well, as best I could report, they've been sort of continually requesting send us your stories for years, and I think this is to develop in part a pool of information that they can use to test and develop these text analytics tools. A lot of it is, I think, practically designed. You know, the types of people that are going to fill out these forms on websites writing a story about how they felt the day Barack Obama was inaugurated are not sort of useful targets for the Obama campaign to know more about the
Yeah,
the
I was
Obama
going to say it's sort
goes.
Of speaking to the converted, right? You
right.
want to expand your base. You want to get those independent voters, those people who are maybe registered Republican but have voted Democrat in the last couple of years. How does this work for those voters?
Right, and the campaign will be talking to probably millions of those voters over the course of the next 9 months through phone banks, volunteer phone banks, paid phone banks, canvassers, and that's where you want to have a sort of, if you've been able to sort of develop the analytical infrastructure to understand, to be able to sift through and interpret that data because you've built it off of these you built a model off of these stories that you've accumulated, then you can apply it to somebody you don't know. And my reporting leads me to believe that the stories were sort of to create that pool of data that they could build a model off that they could start applying to less predictable voters.
My guest is Sasha Eisenberg of Slate. He's been reporting on how candidates are changing the way they communicate with potential supporters by mining your social media sites for information about you. Listeners, are you getting emails or seeing political ads that feel tailor-made for you? What kinds of messages are getting through? Are you noticing a shift in how candidates are reaching out? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. By the way, do these kinds of strategies bother you? Strategies. Do you think they help you cut through the noise of political messaging and hear about the issues you care about? 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our website at WNYC.org. Just click on the Brian Lehrer Show. Sasha, how do you compare the Obama 2012 strategy to the 2008 strategy?
Well, part of it is keeping up or taking advantage of advances in technology. There are certain types of targeting you can do with online ads that just didn't exist 4 years ago, things you can do with mobile technology that didn't exist 4 years ago. But there's also a big problem that behind the facade of this sort of technologically revolutionary campaign that we all talked about 4 years ago, there was this major problem that they had, which was that they had several databases that couldn't interact with one another. And this is where the project codenamed Narwhal that you mentioned in your introduction comes in. You know, they created a database that came out of their website. I think the number is 13 million email addresses they collected, which was unprecedented. And they had a database of 170 million adults, voting age population, and databases of their 3 million contributors and their volunteers. And every department of the campaign had a database that it used with records of individuals, but none of them could communicate with one another. So they, when they were sending you an email, they didn't actually know if you were the same person that a canvasser had visited the night before, or if you had just been to a fundraiser. And so you had duplication of efforts, and you also had some sort of inefficient contacts, and you had a lot of frustration that went on among the staff that they thought that they had collected a lot of good data but actually didn't know how to use it to best possible effect. And one of these big projects, which they're calling Narwhal, is an effort to create a sort of underlying infrastructure that would link each of these databases so that, in effect, you could the campaign would have access to a single individual profile that encompassed your sort of political identity, your activities, online interactions with the campaign there, fundraising, finance, volunteer, activism, and in each part of the campaign would sort of have simultaneous access to all that information. And once again, the sort of goal of all of this is to be able to sort of build richer models of behavior by sort of expanding the pool of available data that you're able to use at once.
And Narwhal, isn't that that whale with the unicorn-like horn coming out of its the top of its head? What is that supposed to indicate? Spearing this information, or I don't know. There's something about unicorns in there that sounds sort of fanciful. Project Narwhal.
Yeah, they're definitely fanciful. I mean, this is a joke that was beyond me or my ability to report out. There's been this a bit of a vogue in the campaign to codename every project, and nobody I could talk to could pinpoint the origins of this one. The joke among some Obama analysts and engineers who worry that they might not be able to have this done and fully functioning by November is that when I asked about a narwhal, somebody said to me, well, have you ever seen one? That it may not, in fact, materialize. One of the points I made when I wrote about this for Slate, though, is that like the narwhal, this sort of mythical unicorn-like thing, this is going to be one of these sort of major innovations this campaign year that's going to be invisible to people. And I think that's one of the big themes of this year is that there may not be major consumer voter-facing changes to the sort of way campaigns operate. I think that to voters, campaigns are going to look a lot like that in 2008. But there are these major innovations going on behind the scenes at campaigns based on how they use data that they have. And it's going to be very hard for voters to understand what's going on. There's not going to be something like, oh, candidates are now using social media, candidates are now using web pages to fundraise, or all these things that in past years it was very obvious what the sort of new shiny piece of technology was. It's really, you know, people are improving the piping underneath the house, but the house is going to look very similar.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer, and I'm speaking with Sasha Eisenberg, who writes about the science of political campaigns for Slate. Sasha, tell us what's going on the Republican side. What has Mitt Romney's campaign been doing this time around, and how has he been using this kind of behind-the-scenes data collecting from social media sites?
Romney has been throughout his career at the forefront of using sort of advanced targeting, micro-targeting techniques, and they have been sort of using this to profile the electorate in each of the primary and caucus states that they've sort of actively contested. And the goal of these micro-targeting models is to be able to develop a sort of prediction of how each individual will vote without talking to them directly. And they use this in Iowa, I think, to great effect, even if the state party later recounted the votes and turned that into an eight vote loss for him, which is that it allowed taking the tremendous amount of information that his campaign had accumulated 4 years ago in Iowa, when he spent a lot of money there and had a big staff that was able to interact with a lot of voters. They had a pretty good idea of who caucused for him in 2008 down to the individual level. And they were able to use that information and then thousands of new phone calls to voters to develop a model that would sort of predict which Iowans were likely to go for him, which other candidates the others were supporting, and which issues each of them cared about, and allowed the campaign to run a very targeted effort, mostly by phones and mail, talking to people who are worth talking to, but keeping this sort of small footprint on the ground, no offices, barely any staff, that allowed Romney to sort of maintain this fiction through much of 2011 that maybe he'd compete in Iowa, maybe he wouldn't, but he really wasn't all in. And so when he came out on caucus night with this tie, the media covered it as sort of this effortless thing on Romney's part, because they had spent the better part of 2011 looking for field offices and a large staff as a sign of commitment into a state, and politics of change. And if you know how to use data well, you don't necessarily need a lot of field offices or a lot of people knocking on doors.
Boy, that's...
Especially if you've made that type of investment 4 years earlier and are able to integrate what you learned then to for lessons today.
That's sort of scary. It's less about the face-to-face, the kissing babies and the handshaking, and it's more about this behind-the-scenes analysis of your donations to political parties, your donations to affiliation groups, your purchasing choices, who you friend or like on Facebook. Is this the end of campaigning as we know it going forward?
No, I mean, there's you still have to get people to like you and want to vote for you. So in the end, campaigns are going to find, and there's a good base of research to believe that there's great value in person-to-person campaigning to mobilize voters, you know, on the part of volunteers and campaigns, that we have a little bit of reason to believe that the candidates do well when they personally campaign in places where they want to increase their support. But the sort of infrastructure of vote counting, which is a lot of what the sort of network of offices and canvassers going around with clipboards, knocking on doors, asking people who they were going to support, that was designed to count votes. That was designed to figure out who's with you, who's against you, who's in the middle, and then you could target your efforts accordingly. That has... In most cases, modern campaigns have figured out how to automate that process. You still need the inputs. You still need to have information about who voters support this year. But especially in Romney's case, where he spent $10 million in Iowa 4 years ago, they were able to make what they learned in 2008 a useful pool of data and build upon it.
So it turned out that
because there was such a weak field, that voters were still sympathetic to him, and they were able to use that to very narrowly target their efforts.
So does this kind of strategy always give the incumbent or the former campaigner a leg up?
Yeah, I think in two ways it does. One is that this infrastructure, to create a pool of data, to create a sort of system for bringing in new data and processing it quickly, takes time and takes, I think more importantly, a sort of culture within a campaign. A campaign has to be willing to invest a lot of money in this stuff that doesn't have immediate sort of that doesn't show flower immediately, right? So if you want to spend $50,000 on TV ads, your ads are on TV the next day. If you want to spend $50,000 on mail, your mail is in mailboxes 4 days later. If you spend it developing a micro-targeting model, all that's going to help you do is send mail. And so campaigns have to have a sort of intellectual culture that sustains building this type of analytical power, and you look at the best examples of it that I think we've seen. You know, this stuff was pioneered by the Bush campaign between 2001 and 2004, where they had 4 years to basically develop a new model for winning an election that was tailored to their particular needs and their view of where the electorate was. Obama is facing different challenges in his reelection, and the technology and data are in a different place, but 4 years to sort of develop and refine an intellectual climate around, you know, around innovation in the area where they need it. And in the case of Romney, Romney's had a sustained relationship with some of the advisors who do this for more than 4 years, and being able to have sort of the consistency in your data collection and analysis is again a big part of that. This is something that, you know, I haven't mentioned Rick Santorum or Newt Gingrich, both of whom have very quickly had to try to scale their campaigns when they started gaining popularity and money. And I don't see any evidence that either of them has tried or succeeded in developing a sort of robust analytical infrastructure to direct their campaigning. And one reason is it's not the type of thing you can often set up in 2 weeks, even if millions of dollars start coming your way and voters are eager to be for you. You're going to probably have to, you know, you're not going to be able to assemble that.
A lot of people are uncomfortable with how Facebook uses their information or how advertisers target them online. Are you hearing any backlash coming from voters? Are they likely to be uncomfortable with this micro-targeting too? Or Are they feeling that it's an advantage to them? It helps them cut through all the different messages they're getting on the campaign trail from the candidates?
I mean, I think people are naturally alarmed when they find out how much information about them is available to people willing to pay for it. Facebook's, you know, is its own instance with their own privacy rules, and frankly, Facebook is one of the most restrictive. Facebook knows a lot about you, and Facebook will allow people to buy ads that reach you, but Facebook won't sell that data to advertisers. It's one way that Facebook sort of keeps its privacy in the advertising space. But you know, the most useful piece of political information, which is where are you registered, what's your party, what elections do you vote in, do you show up to vote, has always been a matter of public record. And I think actually a lot of voters are surprised to even know that is something that's accessible to anybody who wants to go down to the Board of Elections. In the last 10 to 15 years, all this information that's been gathered by commercial agencies, especially the credit rating agencies, which sort of pioneered gathering information on your buying habits and education levels and stuff like this, has been merged with the political information. So what's basically happened is that the information that campaigns in the 1980s used to decide whether to send you a flyer has now been merged with the information that L.L. Bean used in the 90s to send you a catalog. And the quality of computing power and data analytics have just gotten so much better that now there's real refinement in the quality of those projections. It's no longer let's look for women who live in the suburbs who are between the ages of 35 and 64. It's let's have an algorithm mine through hundreds, if not thousands, of variables to develop a really defined universe of those people based on political attitudes.
It gives a whole new meaning to liking a candidate on Facebook. Sasha Eisenberg, we will have to leave it there. Sasha writes about the science of political campaigns for Slate. His book on the subject, The Victory Lab, will be published this fall. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a 30-year court battle against improper loitering convictions shows how tough it is to get the police department to change. Stay tuned.